Hello, and welcome to What Moves Us, the podcast where we ask, what moves us? Or more accurately, what's going to move us in future?
With the Rail Innovation Group's Johanna Randall and Liam Henderson, we look at debates, themes and decisions of the minute that will impact on the way we get about in the future.
Good afternoon, ladies. How are we?
Hello, Liam. How are you?
Well, two things. One, I'm just making sure we're on record. Two, is that I had a meeting with TfL this morning and I drank way too much coffee. And so I am now rambling on and slightly jittery. So I'm going to eat some raspberries and hope to calm down.
Who sets up the thing with too much coffee?
Do raspberries help with calming you down?
Well, I will just ramble on if I need.
And can you talk about why you were meeting with TfL?
Or is No. I'm not going to break their secrets because obviously they've got. I was talking about a particular initiative, but there was something exciting coming down the line, which we shall talk about more in future. It's always nice to have a dialogue with large organisations. As you know, the Rail Innovation Group is charged with making life easier for startups and corporates, enabling them to talk to startups in the right way. So if we can be a conduit for them talking to each other, then that's all good. See? Caffeine fueled.
Brilliant. Yeah, never heard you say that so quickly. Is it also worth mentioning about, do you want to mention that now? About
the election day. Have you voted?
Plans to, inverted commas, fix Britain's railways.
Yes. But let's just check. Have you already voted this morning? Both of you.
No, I've only got Eastern Crime Commissioner.
Oh, okay. Did you vote though?
Not yet.
No elections in Scotland yet, but you never know, depending on what happens with events that have been going on with Scotland.
Oh, yes. If there are elections in Scotland, do you just have to be a resident of Scotland at that moment to vote in Scottish parliamentary elections?
I presume it's just like anywhere else where you're just registered on the electoral register and you get to vote, don't you? But I did find out something interesting about if there is an election in Scotland that's triggered by current events. It's only an interim position because the next election is due to be in 2026 for the Scottish Parliament. And if there was an election this year, if nobody could form a government, then it still is only till 2026.
Oh, so it doesn't sort of reset the clock?
No, it doesn't reset, which I thought was quite interesting.
Hmm.
So I think it's always interesting the things that you learn just by being somewhere that you don't really pay attention to when you're down south or somewhere else, where you know, as opposed to experiencing it.
Yes.
Yes.
True that. So
as we're talking about elections, are we going to start off with the Labour conference, or are we going to talk the Labour manifesto? Are we going to talk about some of the other things that that we wanted to talk about today first?
Well, let's shoot with that. Are you impressed, excited?
What, by the Labour announcements?
Yeah.
I think I'm with the train operators that it's a political rather than a practical solution. But I sort of think that, in one way, it's not that much different to what Conservatives are proposing on the railway, you know, a single unified body called Great British Railways. But I do think that their sort of sense of urgency that's come out of it is a bit more encouraging. So they're saying that the Secretary of State will create a functioning organisation within 6 months and that, you know, then there'll be legislation to form this delivery body, et cetera, et cetera. So one would hope it might kind of be relatively quick to make some of these changes. Yeah. But, you know, there's like a review every 5 years put in there. There's kind of two stages, isn't there, in the reforms that they're talking about. There's like the urgent action and then the plan for change, I think is what they're calling it. So I'm just looking at some of my notes. So they're saying, I would pull out the policy announcements as passenger improvements is quite interesting because they're going to establish a new passenger watchdog, which they're going to call the Passenger Standards Authority, which is edging ticketing improvements. our tickety piece could come back to life, and sort of TFL style best practice on, you know, best price guarantees and all that sort of thing. They're talking about industrial relations, of course, you know, much more integrated working with unions, integrated industrial relations, nurturing the workforce and all of that kind of thing, which is, you know, you would expect, I guess.
So we're talking about the Labour policy, because polling would suggest that they have a good chance of being the next government, and they released a paper. In that paper, though, does it actually say what they want railways to do? What is the point of railways to the Labour proposed government?
Well, they accept that it's in, that they're important in terms of like rail freight and all of that kind of thing. I think they kind of, that, you know, they are. Well, let me start again. Labour have got five missions, haven't they? Which, and one of them is like growth, growth and productivity. And it is quite encouraging that they do see rail as a key driver of growth and productivity. I think that's quite good. That's really positive, especially for high speed rail, because obviously if anyone's trying to get the concept of new intercity high speed rail back on the table after the curtailment of HS2, then that's encouraging that rail do see rail as a key driver for growth, regional productivity, making the regions more productive, all of that kind of thing, because that's obviously all of the arguments that we used around HS2. And obviously this, you know, putting into public ownership, folding up the existing private passenger rail contracts, all of that sort of thing.
Is that because they want to achieve net zero, or they want to get more passengers, or they want to increase public transport? Well, I see Johanna's got her hand up.
I didn't want to sort of like shout over you or anything and that. But I think just to go back to your original question, do they set out, you know, what rail is for? And I think, yeah, I don't think they specifically answer that question. And I don't think they're vision is necessarily any different to what has been said over the last 3 years since the original Grant Shapps-Williams paper was published. But I mean, like, I think they're clear. I mean, like, they're clear, you know, on the importance of railways and the fact, you know, that the importance of rail is to connect the economy and people, and that there has to be an emphasis on job creation, economic growth and reducing emissions. So I think that's clear, that what they want to achieve in that respect, and that, you know, and to deliver that, their vision is for a unified and simplified railway system that can deliver improved services for passengers and provide better value for the taxpayer. And so I don't think really that is much different to what anybody would say, you know, sort of like, you know, tick box, you know. And as I think as Deb's already said, that's about, you know, how are they going to deliver it? And, you know, and we're still on Great British Railways. Well, why it has to be Great British Railways, I don't know. We might as well just call it British Railways in it, to do that. And then they set out, a bit like, you know, linked to their missions and everything, that they have six key objectives, which are about reliability, affordability, efficiency, quality, accessibility and safety. And that is, yeah, and they set that out for both passengers and taxpayers. Yeah, and I think that's where it leads to, you know, sort of like what Debs was saying about the two parts. But I think, you know, I think what interests me about this, and I think, you know, I mean, Liam, if you cast your mind back to the original, you know, the podcast we did after the Williams Shapps review, is that I think we reflected on the fact that there was, you know, we hoped that it would get on and deliver rather than just be focusing in on structure and, you know, bureaucracy and that. And what have we had for 3 years?
Bureaucracy. Yeah,
a focus on structure and, you know, just rearranging deck chairs and that. And I think maybe that's, you know, maybe that's where the recognition from Labour's policy is a bit different, and that's why they're saying on day one, what we're going to do is we're going to tackle the industrial relations and the workforce strategy, and we're going to focus on the reliability and building back the railway. And maybe that's where this is different. But how successful they'll be, what do we think?
Well, you can only hope that they will be. I mean, they're talking about a relentless focus on passengers and freight customers. They're talking about, like, underneath, you know, the sort of the policies that are going to be the drivers to kind of make some of this stuff happen more efficiently. It's like they're going to introduce a statutory duty on GBR, I think, to promote the use of rail freight. I mean, it's interesting. None of it is, as you say, none of it's particularly earth-shattering in one respect. You think any sensible person would come up with these plans if they were looking at our state of our railways. Yeah. What's interesting is that a lot of it talks about, you know, promoting rail and, you know, service, get, you know, better services for passengers, promoting freight, all of it, all of which, if you look at that last report that came out from RIA, that was done by STIA, which basically says that by 2045, I think, that there'll be no more capacity on the West Coast mainline, for example. There'll be, like, before that, there'll be, like, big constraints on freight going on to there and all the rest of it. Given what's happened with HS2 Phase 2, you know, what's going to be really interesting is actually what the plan is for the North in terms of building capacity.
And actually, this plan is quite silent on that, isn't it?
Yeah,
But for obvious reasons.
Yeah, for obvious reasons. No opposition is going to say anything about a project that's been sort of summarily cancelled by a prime minister.
The one thing I think I would say to Labour and Louise Hay, if she does become the Secretary of Transport, though, and if Labour do win the election, is that I think I would be telling them to do something that they won't like to do. And I think in terms of sorting out the industrial relations and also delivering reliability in that, I think they're going to have to quite quickly actually give that to Network Rail and Andrew Haynes to just get on with and do, and not let the DfT interfere with that. Give them their parameters, give them their funding envelope, and just tell them to go ahead and deliver it without any interference with DfT, because I think otherwise they will just get wrapped up in the same issues that the Conservative Party have over government interference and that, and just having to keep going back and forth, you know, for agreement on issues which they know they have no authority to do.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's right. And I think that it's going to be, well, inevitably, the devil's going to be in the detail, isn't it, really? They're going to have to hit the ground running on some of this stuff. Be interesting to see what's going to happen, obviously, in the mayoral elections in West Midlands as well.
Because it's looking quite tight for Andy Street, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of people that I'm speaking to think that, goodness, what's his name? Richard Parker is going to nudge that election. It's going to be, not that obviously Richard Parker is going to work quite, of course, he will work quite comfortably with Andy Burnham, if that is the case. But I would imagine there'll still be, that will kind of hold up a little bit the plans that the mayoral consortium's looking at, just because inevitably change of mayor, will.
Cool.
Do we think the elections will change the policy?
No, I don't think that Richard Parker's going to have a different, I think he's going to be in agreement on what they're all talking about up there around, you know, how important it is to connect Birmingham and Manchester and all the rest of it, and East-West connections and all of that. But I just think, you know, it's not going to be business as usual if Andy Street has to step down. So, I think it's tight. Nobody seems to be able to quite call it. I mean, he's kind of nose ahead in the polls, I think, but yeah.
We won't know till Saturday, will we?
We won't know till Saturday. I think that it could be quite helpful. You know, Richard Parker apparently is very close with Rachel Reeves. So that can only be helpful, you know, in the kind of continuing that engagement with the Treasury team about how important it is to invest.
Right. I see you have a friend in the background, Deb.
Yeah.
Not my friend, that's my daughter. Well, she's my friend, but she's my daughter as well.
Making you lunch?
No, she's making herself some yogurt, which I have just had. We work on very different time scales during the day because we're both on different calls in different rooms, in different parts of the house. That's why I put myself on mute so you can't hear her, so that her rustling isn't in our podcast.
Now, Johanna, you recently were in Dublin for a conference, weren't you? Tell us about that.
I was, and I wanted you to start off with equality so I could tell you something interesting about equality. But anyway, but yes, I was in Dublin for a transport conference that was jointly organised by the European Union and the Department for Ireland in Dublin. And it was a lot of fun. Lots of academic research going on, sort of like some really, really good to hear some of the research that was being done, some of the views of the EU of how about what they're doing with transport and some of their views. And I thought one of the things that I thought, because I did write this down as a quote, because I'm going to say this name really, really badly, because my Polish is not good. But who was the Director General of MOVE for the EU, Magda Kopnacki. I think that's how you say it. It might be Kopnacka. But she was reflecting back on COVID and how important transport is, because she said, without transport, our daily lives wouldn't work. And I think that's quite interesting, given what we're talking about and with the Labour policy, and also, you know, sort of like some of the issues that were raised in the Labour and that we're all experiencing in our daily lives, because she was specifically talking about freight in general to move goods around, you know, and how sort of like how supply chains just stopped because nothing was moving around the world because of COVID. And I just thought that was a really interesting how long it took to get things back to normal. And I think, you know, just, you know, going back to the Labour policy paper that they've issued is just about how nobody goes to the polls thinking about transport. It is always about economy, health, you know, jobs, you know, all of those sorts of things. But transport actually is an enabler for our daily lives that we just don't think about. So I thought, you know, that was sort of like really interesting. And I will talk about something else, but when you talk about equality, about a really interesting presentation that was given at the conference. I think what was really encouraging was because the focus is on research and horizon, and there was an award ceremony for PhD papers and things like that, was the amount of female engineers there were and how diverse the thoughts were and just the ideas that were coming forward. And I was really encouraged to see that, and I hope that will start to sort of like see itself in different, you know, whether it be technology, whether it be innovation, whether it be transport, just to see that coming through into the workforce. So I'm hoping to see that, because of the winners of the award ceremony, they had 50%, actually I think it was actually 60% of the top position were female. So I thought that was really, really encouraging to see.
Yes, encouraging. Now, why is it that you went to this conference in Dublin? Did you fancy a trip to Dublin, or did you have a...
He doesn't fancy a trip to Dublin.
I can imagine getting from Scotland to Dublin was very easy by rail. But were you hoping to go for a particular outcome?
Yes. So what's, as you know, my partnership, Future Travel Studio, we were successful in gaining funding with Innovate UK for a first of a kind project, Dream Suite, where we are developing a prototype of a flatbed seat to use for night trains. And as part of that funding, you get access to all sorts of other grants and opportunities that would not necessarily be open to you. And one of those was a grant towards visiting the conference, so towards your fees for going to the conference and also travel expenses. So thank you very much, Innovate UK, for supporting doing that. And that was, and that's very important for us, because we were wanting to make, we want to make contact with people within the EU, because potentially in terms of developing our prototype and our product, we're looking for partners within Europe, but also specifically we wanted to make contact with Department of Transport in Ireland for one of the case studies that we're developing.
Right. And going to guess the longest train ride in Ireland.
The look, well, ambitiously, we're looking at a connection into Holyhead. So, I don't know whether you're aware or listeners are aware, but the European Union have a network called TENS-T, which is all about linking up the whole of Europe by high speed and night trains. But Ireland, as its name suggests, the island of Ireland, has a lot of sea around it and also the UK in between. So it's not been possible. So as part of one of our case studies, we're looking to see if we can fix that connectivity link with the Dream Suite product. Right. So it connects into ferry services from Ireland, because at the moment, connectivity from Ireland is not very good. If you want an alternative to aviation. And it's interesting, because I think we mentioned earlier on about ticketing and things. I did fly to Ireland, and this is some of the madness of our policy. And also, I mean, I would have gone by train and by ferry, but it wasn't terribly convenient. But you can get a really good ferry and train price going to Ireland. I think from Pitlochry to Belfast, I think the fare is something like £60 single. It's something ridiculously cheap. That is an amazing price, really. And it's the same if you go London via Holyhead to Dublin. So I think there's some rules in there that says, yeah, about, you know, that subsidise in some way to fix that connectivity gap. So it's a really good value way to go. But particularly going from Scotland at the moment, it's very difficult, because there was a fire at Ayr quite a while ago, and they still haven't fixed the link. So not only do you have to get off at Glasgow, you have to then change trains again onto a bus and then get back on a train. So it takes about 5 hours just to get to Stranraer to get the ferry. So it's actually quicker to go to Holyhead than it is from but it's still not terribly convenient. But that's the problems when things are, you know, and I've spoken to various people, and I don't think people really understand really why it's taking so long to fix it. And I'm not quite sure whether it's sort of like part of some, and I've got to be careful, because I'm not quite sure whether it is part of some legal issues or something, because it was a third party damaged the railway.
Right.
So that's been the problem.
Right. Mm.
And this third party were told they needed to fix their problem, and it had been an issue before it became a problem. So I'm not quite sure if it's part of legal wranglings or something. I'm not too sure.
It's made us a very interesting wider point. Not that I want to, not wanting to get into the legalities around that, but just know that we allow, we are sort of, we're quite heavily regulated in a lot of areas in this country, but somehow or other we allow a situation like that one. And I don't know what that situation is, but I'm just using it as an example. Be able to sort of hold up our, basically hold up our connectivity and the ability to get their trains back on that part of the network,
And it's been a long time. It's certainly been over 12 months. It's been a long time.
Yeah. And it's just kind of, you just think that's where we need to, I'm trying to plug High Speed Rail Group with my High Speed Rail Group hat on, but I will say that we're looking to a report together, looking at kind of not lessons learned really, because others are doing that. The Institute for Civil Engineers and others are doing stuff on lessons learned from HS2, but really just looking at the industry's ability to deliver and what stymies the ability to deliver new infrastructure in this country. Because most of the companies that were kind of being indirectly accused of wasting public money by, ramping up the costs of HS2, for example, have all delivered massive infrastructure projects elsewhere in the world, more quickly and probably much more closely aligned to the original budget, because there are other aspects in this country that cause those problems, and that's whether that's planning or whether that's, whatever it might be, the parliamentary processes, the way we do things in the, you know, in that sense. I'm not advocating for any, you know, I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm not saying, you know, we HS2's got the world-class environmental mitigation, world-class viaducts, you know, et cetera. I'm not saying we shouldn't have those, but I'm just saying we're very stuck in the way that we seem to do things here. And it's like, for me, that's one of the biggest things. It's like somebody described it as like a something mindset. I can't remember. I'll have to look it up. But, you know, it's like a mindset of the way we do things in rail and infrastructure. And I think that has to change. It just made me think of that, Johanna, when you said, you know, that's the reason why you can't get a far, you can't get on the train to you know, to get to Ireland, and you haven't been able to for a year because of some, you know, some weird thing that's going on that means that that, that part of the network can't be fixed.
Yeah, but are you going to start talking about the deep state and the block?
No, no, I'll leave that for another one. Although I did, you know, I have been thinking about that a lot since we went to that excellent presentation the other morning at that breakfast event on AI. I must say I was most impressed by that
presentation. Oh, that sounds intriguing.
Great presentation about AI, and Deb managed to get a question where she managed to get in her love of Star Trek.
Yeah, I did. I managed to get better. They only took three questions from the floor, Johanna, and one of them was mine. Yes. And they didn't want to. I felt they didn't want to really answer. None of them really answered my question. It was completely directed at the professor from Cambridge because I thought he was fantastic. He just smiled and let the others answer it, and they didn't answer it very well. But yeah.
So what was your question?
Well, my question was, because they were all talking about, you know, like how particularly he was talking about how you know, like we can't sort of like. There's no point in us fighting against the fact that artificial intelligence is more intelligent than us, because of course it is, like a million times more. What makes us different and what makes us kind of separate and special is that our vulnerabilities as human beings. I mean, he was very philosophical in his kind of talk. There was others that were talking about, you know, hardcore AI stuff that's going on, but he was much more kind of, he's like the professor of deep mind at Cambridge University or something. He's got some amazing, yeah. He was pretty cool. And I thought he was quite handsome as well. I don't know if he's listening, but anyway. I said, you know, in my love of Star Trek, so my favourite character on Star Trek, The Next Generation, the best Star Trek, obviously, the only one I watch, is the android. Because I've always loved Data, the android, because he's always trying to, you know, like, because he can do everything. He's like, you are, I always felt like he was like my ideal husband, because he's got no feelings and he could just do everything. And you know what I mean? He's like strong. He can do anything, you know, like he can do everything. He can do all my work for me. He can do everything. But he's always desperately trying to understand feelings, like what it's like to feel things. So my question to them was, you know, do you think, given that all the data that's now out there in the universe about feelings, because it's all we bloody talk about now is people's feelings and all the rest of it, much more so than we probably ever have, is will these artificial intelligence entities learn so much about feelings that actually we won't be able to distinguish between whether they are feeling it or whether they're just simulating feeling it?
Oh,
I know, right?
So what did they say?
They didn't engage with the philosophical point that I was making. I think they just, what did they say, Liam? They just said,
simulate. They could learn to simulate, but basically just what they just said, no.
Yeah, they just said, oh no, they'd only ever be able to simulate feelings because they can't feel. My point was, at what point does simulating feelings become feelings? You know what I mean? Like, in a sense, how would we distinguish between them simulating feeling and feeling? You know what I mean? It was a much deeper philosophical.
Dogs already do that. Dogs already simulate, like, oh, I've got a sad face and everything else, because they know that that's what humans want to see.
Yeah, but dogs aren't AI. They're actual.
I know, but that's something learn how to fool our feelings and our sympathies.
Yes.
Well, that's the learning to fool, isn't it? So that's really the thing, isn't it? Does it learn?
Yeah. Well, somebody's just got married to a chatbot, haven't they, last week?
Interesting, isn't it?
The amount of time I spend on that.
Anyway, we're going.
We're going off topic, but it was interesting though, because I would like to do a whole discussion around this bit.
It was a really interesting morning. It was worth it. I had to get on the really early train to get there, for it was like breakfast, like start time. And it was good because it meant that then me and Liam would had a work day being in London early. But I'm really glad I went. It was really interesting, I thought.
I thought so, yes. Good.
Good. Anyway, back to Dublin.
No, I think we're moving on to equality now, aren't we? Or was there more things about Dublin you wanted to talk about? But I tell you, the other thing was that they really do know how to hold a conference in Dublin as well. It was so entertaining. Best conference I've ever been to. There was Irish
dancing,
there was bands on. I mean, like, it was really, really, really lively.
Oh, that's great.
I really enjoyed it.
Good. Did you public transport to the airport?
I got a bus from the airport into to the centre, but I had quite a tight deadline to get my flight leaving the conference because I had something else to go to. So I Ubered. Well, actually, I didn't Uber it because, interestingly, I downloaded the local, not interesting at all, but I downloaded the local app because I'd seen it advertised, and they were €50 cheaper to get to the airport than Uber.
Wow.
Because it was going to cost me €75 to get to the airport, which was more expensive than my flight. Yeah. Because obviously they do surge pricing, don't they?
They do.
Yeah.
Right. Last thing then is, I think I said to you last week, and I said I was going to a Women in Rail event. And I know that you're very keen to hear the output of that. So I went to obviously I'm not a woman in rail, but I went to a Women in Rail launched, what would we call it, initiative. So there is the diversity charter, which lots of organizations in the rail sector have signed up to, and their Women in Rail organization has started a workshop that they hope to take national about diversity in rail, and sort of rather than just sit and listen to a talk about diversity, is turned into like a debating workshop. And so I turned up. I had no idea who the other people were, but we were split into two groups to discuss whether we were, well, basically we had to take the role of being either for or against collecting data on diversity. And then obviously came to a debate at the end. I was in the minority because I came to the conclusion that we should not collect data because it's not very useful. But it was very interesting not knowing who people were. You didn't get a chance to sort of judge what they were saying in the context of why they were saying it. So hearing just people's straight opinions was actually quite eye-opening.
So what's the case for and against then?
Well, the case for is, unless you have data, you don't know what the scale of the problem is, effectively. And also you need to measure to see if you're succeeding at making diversity. The case against was, one, what data are you collecting? Because, what do you call diversity? So what are you asking people to say they are or they aren't? Only 40% of people are going to fill out your survey anyway. So you end up with a pigeonholed boxes of 40% of people. And the chances are that the people who are most interested in diversity are going to fill out your survey. So you're going to end up with oversampling the most diverse people, showing your company as being more diverse than it actually is.
Well, that's interesting.
I just want to finish off. The other point is that when you sample, you're in a sample, so most corporations do a survey and then it takes about 6 months to process that and then get the answers. And so you actually got out-of-date information at that moment. And then, because I was against, I remembered all these things. Their point is that when you've the diversity you're capturing at that moment, this call looks diverse because there are two women on the call and one man, but that doesn't count all of your life experience. So I might have gone through way more struggles than you two to get to this place in my life, to get to this place professional work. So, but I wouldn't count as a diversity box, even though I might have come from a different background. And then lastly is, even if you do get diversity, according to your pigeonhole boxes of what diversity is, that's no guarantee that you've got diversity, the current cabinet would show you that it looks very diverse, but they all actually clearly think exactly the same way. Those were the general things.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because I used to do a lot of work in local government on exactly that. Like, lots of local authorities were really, like, really struggle with getting people to fill out that kind of stuff. But equally, I know it's slightly different in a public sector context like that, or local authority, because they're obviously delivering services. So they need to know lots of stuff about people to be able to deliver services effectively. But it's also about digging a bit more deeply than, you know, because even in, you know, delivering rail services and stuff, you have to be able to communicate really well while you're asking people questions. If you do that, then your response rate is significantly improved, because you can't just accept that only 30% are only ever going to fill out these forms or what have you. That's kind of like an unacceptable place to park yourself. You have to be able to say, I was trying to find it actually just to remind myself, I've got it somewhere in hard copy, Stonewall, the organisation Stonewall, used a really good leaflet ages ago, like literally when the Equality Act came out, 2010 sort of time. It was called What's It Got To Do With You? And it was just a really good, useful document that we used to sort of send out to local, you know, like reach out to local authorities to say, like, have a look at this. Because it was just kind of just really, really, really clear, simple way of just sort of saying, one, this is how you need to communicate this stuff to people to encourage them to respond, because you have to relate it to something so that people can think, okay, fair enough, you're asking me about my, I don't know, sexuality, but that's why. And then obviously it was a Stonewall thing, so it was because local authorities were feeling particularly awkward about asking people back then about sexuality. Then they'd be happy to ask, you know, are you male, are you female, and all of that sort of stuff, what, you know, what faith you are, what, and all of that, but not necessarily so much about sexuality. But then, you know, if local authorities can prove through their kind of that there's reasons that they need to know that, whether it's community safety, or it often was back then, do you know what I mean? Like being able to kind of target policies around hate crime, da, 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 all of that kind of thing. So it was really, so I think, yeah, there's something in that that is important to collect data, but one, only if you communicate to people really well that that's why you're collecting it, and two, that you actually do what you say you're going to do with the data, you know, and sort of and use it properly, effectively, triangulate it with other bits of data so that you can actually really kind of like use it for leveraging new policies, making a case for stuff, whatever you want to use it for. That is my soapbox, and I will get off it now.
Well, I mean, because I think, you know, Liam makes a really good point about the case against data, because, you know, if you were to look at, you know, data that, you know, Women in Rail with NSAR have been collecting, the position actually looks worse overall in rail since they've been collecting it. It hasn't moved the dial, so to speak. And again, you know, as you say, Liam, you know, it's only collecting certain levels of diversity. And I was having a conversation with a senior rail leader who shall remain nameless, and we were having a conversation about quotas, you know, because, you know, should data be linked to quotas? Because you're only going to change it if you set out targets or commit, you know, dedicated commits. And I think that's probably the missing link in data collection at the moment, is that, one, not everybody's doing it, or only people that are interested. But I think the majority of people are interested in doing so. Is there something for making it mandatory for certain levels of organisations, particularly within rail, if that's what we want to do? And should that also be linked to objectives and quotas that are also mandated as well, and to grow that? But
that's my point, is collecting data is not going to move the dial. Collecting data doesn't do anything. You just collect data and you just stick it, whatever, you know, leave it on your computer, you know, do whatever you want to do with it. Collecting the data doesn't mean anything. But it only means something if you actually do something with that data when you've collected it. That's my point.
But one of the, you know, keeping with sort of like the women question, because must be about a decade ago now, mustn't it, that it was mandated that boards should have a quota of women on them if they were a FTSE 100 company. And that, because I think that was implemented under the coalition government under David Cameron. But when I was talking to this senior rail leader, they were saying that the majority of women are actually against quotas because there's kind of this view that, you know, particularly amongst senior women, was that, well, I had to work my way up to this, so why should anyone get an easy ride? And yeah, and I don't know whether to do that, but there's an article in this week's Spectator, which picked up on an article from the BBC this week, which was that because they had I didn't see the BBC article about train drivers in the UK are overwhelmingly white middle-aged men.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the overall article, it talks about other things, other policy areas in California of all places where they have quotas for all sorts of different diversity in that, but not the diversity of experience in that. But I thought it was an interesting article because it was the rage against the diversity angle and should we stop worrying about diversity and just get on with your work and stuff and don't worry about it anymore, because the whole point of the Spectator article was that, you know, if you were in China, everyone would be Chinese. If you're in India, everyone would be Indian, and we are still predominantly white, and so, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it was typical sort of like Spectator article, but, you know, does it really, you know, add anything to the debate, you know? And
I do think that, I mean, quotas is only one potential sort of lever to, and it's not a very palatable one with a lot of people for many reasons, which some of which you just said, Johanna, but there's lots and lots of other ways of interpreting the data and then doing something about it. You know, you don't just have to, you know, it's like when I worked in local government, we did quite a big piece of work at London Borough of Tower Hamlets, I think, who are obviously, Tower Hamlets is a massive, really, really diverse borough. Though not, you know, the majority population isn't white, really. They've got great diversity in the sort of lower paid jobs in the local authority. But as you move up through the hierarchy, as you know, you were saying, Johanna, like in a same in the company, you know, you might have lots of people doing jobs that are in the lower paid bits of the organisation, and then as you go higher up, there's less diversity as you go up and up. There, you know, a local authority can't do quotas. You know what I mean? But what we did through some work with the local government association was look at some other, you know, kind of other policy levers that we could use. So we did, you know, we did like sort of mentor, you know, looked at mentoring schemes, looked at like lots of different, and all of the things that we looked at were using the deep data that we had, look at what might work. Do you know what I mean? So I think that's, again, that's the point, isn't it, for me, of data, is only collect it if you're going to use it, and use it well, you know, be able to kind of influence what your thinking is around, you know, what you're trying to achieve, which is obviously more diversity wherever, you know, there it's lacking.
Well, I guess, so just two things to come back on that is, one of the things which I keep raising whenever someone gives me a soapbox at a conference or anything else, and they talk about diversity, is that I think the railway industry is particularly bad at this, of it thinks of people either in the rail industry or outside the rail industry, and it excludes everyone who's outside it. So particularly when you're talking about samples of women in the industry, most people in the rail industry think that the only people who work in the rail industry are sort of the people in the big established companies that work in rail. Digital suppliers or whoever might be advisory on the side, they don't count as being part of the rail industry. Whereas in our community, we do have a fair number of women founders and women tech developers, but they're not counted as the rail industry because they're not engineers who are inside this edifice. And I think that skews the figures, because you end up just thinking, oh, in the traditional old-fashioned jobs, we don't have diversity, but we do have diversity in the new modern rail industry. And the second thing, which I posed the question at the end of the event, which I was posing a little bit as devil's advocate, was, you, Deb raised, mentioned it earlier, is the point of diversity, is I was asking these people, I raised the question of what is the point of diversity? why are you so keen to have diversity in your organization as a private company? And they said, because it makes better products. And I said, well, that's fine. So surely you just have more success in the private company with more diversity. And they said, no, because we supply to the public sector. So I said, why doesn't the public sector specify a product that's so difficult to make that only a diverse team can make the highest quality products? And they said, because the public sector don't do that, they specify quotas. So all they have to do is meet the quota of diversity and they'll get into the tender. They don't have to be diverse, they just have to make the quota of diversity.
What do you mean make the quota of diversity?
As in tick, this many 50% women, 50% from minority ethnic backgrounds, 50% of this. They don't have to do anything to actually make a better product, they just have to be diverse. But that can't be the output in itself.
No, and I think it was, I mean, going back to that Spectator article, I think it, I mean, because some of it was, you know, sort of like, you know, quite amusing and that, but because they're in the article, they mention the head of talent diversity inclusion at Southern Railway as the article, and in the BBC article, they're reporting about, you know, that diversity freshens the rail network, and it's really important that we have diversity of thinking within the railway, which is important as diversity of ethnicity because it brings creativity. And I think a valid point about this is that he's not, you know, that the writer of the article is not looking for their train driver or somebody to be, you know, to be creative. And I think it very much depends on what role it is that you're doing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I guess so, yeah. But I think also it's not just, I mean, diversity isn't just about ethnicity, is it? It's about loads of things. It's about everything that's in the, you know, in the protected characteristic list and stuff that got left out, you know. Been loads of stuff written recently about, you know, working class people versus not working class people, socioeconomic status, all of that stuff. So it's like there's a whole thing about diversity, neurodiversity, which is particularly relevant, you know, for sort of tech digital companies, I think. But I think it's like, you know, it's a bit like bringing it back to the AI thing again. It's what they said at that breakfast thing we went to, Liam, is, you know, they all said people that are the most successful in those big tech companies are the ones that come from an arts background or come from a different background and have got into that through, you know, a different route. And that's, you know, I mean, again, going back to my local government days, you know, we used to try really hard to get people from different departments to go and work in other departments for, you know, like a month to go and just, you know, learn how waste management go, you know, when you come from a library background is a bit weird. But I mean, it's like, actually you get, we did that under the guise of equality and inclusion. Do you know what I mean? Because actually you get people going into a different, if you go into a completely different department in, obviously local government's got lots, you know, quite a wide ranging set of things that it delivers. You people come up with all sorts of ideas because they're just looking at something that everyone else does what they do day in, day out. They're used to doing it, you know, and this is so relevant for rail because you just do the same thing because that's how you've learned to do it, no matter what you're talking about, and that's how it's done. And someone can come in from another department and just go, why do you do it like that? And then everyone goes, I don't know.
I always done it that way.
You know what I mean? And that's all that. I know that sounds like I'm being really crass, but it's not, because I've seen it happen. And like, we did loads of really interesting study, you know, programs around that and got some really interesting outcomes. So I think it's, and it's something that is so relevant to your point, Mian, you know, that because rail is very much, you know, I mean, I've only been in rail for a relatively short time, a decade. And, I rest my case. But, you know, most people you see have been in rail whole careers. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Obviously, they're all incredibly, you know, great people. But, you know, I think the rail industry could really do with, really benefit from getting some, you know, people from other sectors in. And I think that's happening. I mean, I don't think that's, you know, that seems to be happening. It needs to happen more.
That is interesting, you know, just sort of like, you know, just on the concluding point about, you know, how rail does kind of suck you in, you know, because everyone talks about the railway family, yeah, and that, and then before you know it, you have been here 30 years because you just move around different areas of it, getting, you know, getting different experience, you know, for good or bad, yeah, and that, and it, and I think And I think probably lots of other industries are probably the same in that respect, because once you sort of like, it's almost like, you know, if you've been pigeonholed as a baddie as an actor, isn't it? That, you know, once you've worked in a realm for a long time, it's then, you know, even though you might be an operational management professional, it's then very difficult to, you know, all transferable skills, but then it's very difficult to then move to another industry, even though your experience is operations.
Yeah.
Wow.
So what was the conclusion then, Liam?
There was no conclusion because it was a workshop discussion.
So what's happening next with the Women in Rail debates then?
Well, as you two are both Women in Rail, I assume that you will have some sort of communication about what's going on, what's happening. I assume they're going to
get anything from Women in Rail.
Oh, well,
I'm not a woman in Rail, clearly.
I do.
You're not part of the gang, are you?
I don't think I'm part of the gang. I get occasionally invited to things, but I think it's
it's free to join.
What an afterthought.
It's free to join, Deb, just to sign up.
Yes, maybe I should. It's probably my bad. I shouldn't be expecting.
And then you'll get updates about things going on.
Yes, I do speak to lots of people.
Sign up for the workshops.
I will sign up for the workshops because they sound actually really interesting.
And while you're at it, sign up for our summer social on the 6th of June in Bristol.
Yes, we hope to see you all there. It's going to be a good one, and hopefully the weather will be lovely and we'll be in Bristol.
Definitely will be lovely and sunny. Right, I will see you all next time.
Excellent.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to another episode of What Moves Us. We hope we moved you. For more episodes, you'll definitely want to subscribe to our channel.
Till next time.